From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Is There Anybody There? By Charles Burkin. Sir Charles Burkin contributed several horror stories to the Creep series, which lasted from 1932 to 1936 as Charles Lloyd. He made a comeback to the genre after retirement 30 years later with 7 paperback original collections comprising over 80 tales. Nearly all of these concentrate on grand guignol physical, non-supernatural horror, but among them can be found a small number of excellent ghost stories. This story, Is There Anybody There?, is taken from The Smell of Evil. Is there anybody there? Millie Ackland knew that she was all done in the cottage. It had been stupid of her to call out, but she could not help feeling nervous. She had pretended to Ida that she had not minded her going off to London for 2 nights. She had told her that she did not mind in the very least, and that of course she would be all right, perfectly all right, she had repeated with emphasis. What could possibly happen to her? She appreciated her solicitude, but honestly, there was no need for it. She had said what Ida had wished her to say, and had felt a little heroic. It was unfortunate that Ida was ignorant of the extent of her heroism. No doubt she had reassured herself about Millie's safety with the fact that their neighbors, the Kiernans, lived only a few yards away, to the left of the blue gate at the bottom of the path. Blue had been Ida's choice. Everyone else had their gates painted green or white. So why should they not show some originality? Then there was Monica Findhorn, whose house was on the other side, and who could actually look into their garden from her bathroom window. There was no reason for apprehension. How could there be? Ida must go off to her cousin and enjoy herself as she had arranged, and there was no more to be said. Millie Ackland and Ida Rankin had shared Rosemary Cottage for the past 2 years, and they had done a great deal to improve it, more, in fact, than they had been able to afford. They had installed a bathroom and an up-to-date kitchen, and had built a lean-to glass house on the south side, and they had herm-sealed the warped windows, which nobody could deny had been essential for health as well as for comfort, and which could not be regarded as having been an extravagance. Millie had known Ida since they had been and hatched Dean together more than 50 years ago. It sounded so antediluvian when she said it out loud, which she did sometimes, to hear the gratifying astonishment that was her listener's reaction. Ida and I, she would boast, have known one another for more than half a century, since we first met in the Lower Fourth at Hatch Dean in 1906. And it was true. They had always kept up. And when the time had come for the respective retirements from the scholastic careers which each had chosen, what could have been more natural than for them to decide to enjoy the closing years of their lives in one another's company? Ida may have her shortcomings, Millie often said with a twinkle, but then so have I. and we have no unpleasant shocks in store for one another, as sometimes happens to newlyweds. She meant nothing peculiar by this announcement. Ida had been headmistress at Moatlands, an expensive and rather snobbish school, which had grown even more militantly exclusive after the arrival there of several of the European princesses. Millie herself had never been officially a headmistress, but on occasion had acted as such at Charleville House, when there had been an illness among the staff. Had originally been intended for the daughters of the clergy and professional classes, and Millie considered it to be both an education and in games far in advance of Moatlands. She did not, of course, say this to dear Ida. The majority of the Charville girls had had to work in later life and had been trained to become useful, self-reliant, and cultured citizens. Rosemary College had, to begin with, been a laborer's dwelling with, in house agent's parlance, two up and two down. That was before that added the improvements. The down, which had been the former kitchen, was now the dining room, and the new kitchen, with a communicating hatch, had been built on at the back underneath the bathroom. It was all most convenient. They had bought the cottage for £1,500, which, in view of its deplorable condition and lack of amenities, they had considered to be daylight robbery, but they had been assured that it had been, in fact, a bargain. Millie gravely doubted if her father, the Reverend Maurice Ackland, had he been alive, would have regarded it as such, but then values had changed and everything had become so terribly dear. Monica Finehorn had had the nerve to tell them that they had managed to get it so cheaply owing to its reputation. Ida had looked at her quizzically with raised eyebrows, waiting for her to explain herself, and when she had failed to do so, she has said humorously, "Are you implying, dear Miss Finehorn, that our sweet cottage used to be the local house of ill fame?" Miss Finehorn had smiled and shaken her head, sharing in the joke. "No, Miss Rankin, I am not. It is supposed to be haunted. A young ploughman is said to have murdered his wife soon after the end of the First War. It was before my day. There was a lot of speculation, and although some people declared that he was innocent and that it was just a case of cherche la femme, he was executed for the crime and is said to be earthbound. Since then, Rosemary Cottage has changed hands no less than 3 times. You know how these superstitious villagers can be about such matters, especially in East Anglia." She had busied herself with the teapot. "For you ladies," she went on playfully, "the idiotic tale has proved most beneficial, for, as you know, the price of property around here has risen scandalously. He worked for the Fillingham family," she finished inconsequently. "I am not likely to lose any sleep over your revelations," Ida had said. "There is not a house in the country that has not been the scene of a death. And the older the building, the more of them it must have witnessed." "But not deaths by violence," Millie had put in. "When did it happen, Miss Finehorn?" "In 21, 22. I'm afraid I can't tell you the precise date. But it was on Midsummer Eve. And please, will you call me Monica, both of you? I hope that we may be good friends as well as near neighbors." Ida had laughed about it on their way home. "We are apparently indebted to Piers Ploughman for getting us a real bargain," she had said. "It's an ill wind. Not that it was not bad luck on the wretched victim." She had no patience with the psychic world. She had once misguidedly attended a seance, and it had been perfectly obvious to her that the medium, a woman, had been an outrageous fraud. Tommyrot. She was not certain that Millie altogether shared her views, although the dear thing had known better than to express openly any such beliefs. She had been known to drop hints. Ida suspected that Millie thought herself receptive to vibrations from the other world, and that she was rather proud of it, as it made her feel superior, like claims of being old souls always heartened reincarnationists and made them quite insufferable. Millie naturally refrained from parading her fanciful theories, for she knew that if she did so, they would inevitably receive short shrift. Millicent Acklin had, with difficulty, kept her accomplishment to herself. She was devoted to Ida and would do nothing which might annoy or vex her, or which would endanger the harmony of their lives together. And it was for this reason that she had resolved to hold her tongue. She had begun to hear things the very evening after they had been to tea with Monica Finehorn. Perhaps, she thought, it had been Miss Finehorn's disclosure that had opened the door of her awareness, had tuned her into the right wavelength. She would have known in any case that the house was haunted, but the knowledge might not have come to her so soon. At first she had caught only a few disjointed and whispered words, and weeks and sometimes months had gone by before she had heard more. But with the passing of time, the voices had grown gradually more distinct and had come to her with more regularity. And recently she had begun to think that if she were to turn her head quickly enough, she would be able to catch sight of the speakers. She tried to do so now. "Is there anybody there?" she called. She knew that with a supernatural one must never show fear. There were four of them. She had discovered that very early on. A man, two women, and a child. When they spoke to one another, Millie was usually alone in a room, but of late they had started to do so even when Ida had been seated opposite to her, reading or knitting or engaged in solving a crossword puzzle. But invariably Ida had appeared sublimely unconscious of anything untoward, and Millie had hesitated to alarm her or to draw down upon herself the pungent dryness of her tolerant rebuke. Beyond Miss Finehorn's somewhat vague statement that a murder had taken place in their cottage, Millie had no very clear picture of the personalities concerned, but by now the characters were familiar to her to the extent that she was sometimes tempted to take part in the dialogue. There was Adam Loft, the dominant figure who, from what she had heard and subsequently observed, had been a handsome, conceited, and hard-drinking man with a controlled but bullying nature. There was his wife Nancy, a young woman of dull mind who subconsciously rejoiced in being downtrodden and who gave every evidence of being a mental and physical slattern. Then there was her child, Lucy, a tiresome little girl who was alternately spoiled and punished by her father and nagged at by her mother. Millie found Judith Cromer the most interesting. She was having an affair with Adam. She lived in the village, was unmarried, and was obviously terrified that her family would discover the liaison in which she was engaged. She was quite intelligent, but her judgment had been clouded by her overwhelming sexual desire. She had been trying to persuade Adam to emigrate with her to Australia. Millie knew that he had no intentions of doing so, and she knew also that he was a man of considerable obstinacy. All that he wanted to do was to continue his cohabitation with Judith in his own home and on his own terms, and to prevent his wife and Judith's parents from finding out about the relationship. Millie acknowledged that in spite of herself, despite her natural alarm, she was growing more and more interested and involved in the lives of these people, just as some viewers are inextricably netted by the enthralling dramas of television serials. She knew that she should switch off, but was incapable of closing her mind. She had been jockeyed into being an unwilling eavesdropper, and it had not been of her own choosing, and she began to fear that she might easily find herself slipping into the role of voyeur of scenes and also of actions that were for the eyes of the participants alone. She remembered the first snatch of talk which she had overheard. There had been the slam of a door, and the man had said to his wife, "I don't know what you do with yourself all day, Nance. Honest, I don't. Lucy looks like a gypsy, and the house is no better than a slum. There's not even a hot meal on the table, and not in the oven, I'll bet. Search me why I married you. Must have been off my rocker. He had spoken with unconcealed bitterness. And Nancy had answered him. I'm out of sorts, Adam. Really, I am. It's the headache. Somehow, it doesn't seem to lift, no matter what Lucy's been trying. You've no idea. If it's not one thing, it's another. I'll be glad when she gets off to school. She had paused, and there had been the sound of sniffling. And I'll be gladder still when she's old enough to go into service, though that won't be for a long while yet, not for another 9 years. I try to do my best, Lord knows. There had been a silence. Then the man had said roughly, just look at you, like something the cat brought in. You might be 50, not 30. You can't be bothered with cooking or cleaning, and you're always tired out. The voices had grown indistinct, and Ida had come in and stripped off her gardening gloves and had said, you must order some more coal so as to be ready for the winter. Do remind me, Millie. Oh, and Miss Finehorn, Monica. I should say telephone while you were at the chemist's this morning. I forgot to tell you. She wondered if we could take charge of the tombola at the church fete in July. I told her that we would be delighted to do so. Did I do right, Millie? She had smiled kindly, aware that her friend enjoyed the companionship of such social activities. Adam Loft's voice had been very different when he had been talking to Judith Cromer. It was slower and softer, and took on a caressing and deeper slur. Not that he was in the habit of speaking a great deal when they were together. It seemed to Millie that it was the girl who did most of the talking. On such occasions when Judith called, there was just the two of them. Nancy and Lucy were always out. After they had made love, and Millie was perfectly aware that this was the sole object of Judith's visits, the girl would keep on pestering Adam about his leaving Nancy and going away with her to start a new life. And nobody would know us, she used to say. If we went overseas, we could make a fresh start. Nancy's no good to you, Adam, and you know it. She'll only drag you down to her level. You don't love her, and she loves nobody but herself. She's not got it in her. She'll ruin you, mark my words. Don't I mean anything to you, darling? We could be someone if we went to Canada or Australia, achieve something. There's wonderful openings in the colonies for people like us. I had a letter from John only yesterday. He and Doris are doing ever so well in Vancouver. Adam had avoided replying directly to these urgings. Instead, there had been sounds of kissing and half-hearted protests and the creaking of leather, which Millie thought must have come from the old hide sofa, which she and Ida had found abandoned in an outhouse, and which the cost of repair having proved exorbitant, they had subsequently sold at an auction on the green for 10 shillings. And so the story had unfolded. There were no twists, no unexpected developments. Adam's affair with Judith gathered momentum. His irritation with and dislike of his wife increased, as did the mounting tediousness of his child's behavior, which maddened him and frayed his nerves. Then a few days before Ida's proposed visit to London, Judith had come to Adam and told him that she was pregnant. Millie had not heard this scene before. She did not think that the girl was unduly distressed by this occurrence, no doubt largely because the circumstance might enable her to force Adam's hand. And rather to her surprise, the young man, after a brief outburst of impatient disgruntlement, had taken the news quite well and had made no effort to dispute her claim of his paternity. The events which she overheard were not, to Millie's annoyance, always in continuity. She was anxious to know the outcome, but on the next occasion, when she was able to tune in, it was to a conversation that she had already listened to several times, and thus she knew exactly what would happen. Adam had come in from work and had sat down to unbuckle his leggings, which he would throw over to Nancy to clean and polish for him while he went out to wash at the pump. Her protest at his request would be followed by the thud of his heavy boots as they, too, were tossed in her direction. And then would come her whining voice. "It seems so silly and such a waste of time. They'll only get muddy again in the morning, and I've been on the go all day. Hardly been off my feet since you left the house." "So you want me to go down to the village all mucky, is that it?"
"I don't want you to go down to the village at all, Adam, and, well, you know it. Wasting your money in the Pelican with that Bill Haskins and all the rest, and then stumbling back home with a skin full and a face as black as thunder, so that I'm afraid to open my mouth."
"Well, I earned the bloody money, don't I?"
"I'm not denying it's your money, and I do wish you wouldn't swear in front of Lucy. It's how you spend your wages that riles me. Lucy's not had a new frock this year, and come to that, nor have I. Not for a 12-month. After all, we are your wife and child, your own flesh and blood."
"Why can't I have a new dress?" It was a little girl. "Why must you drink so much beer, Daddy?" "For Christ's sake, shut up, can't you?"
It was by now the second week of June, and it had been during March that Millie had just seen the hazy outlines of her speakers, outlines which had grown increasingly detailed until she had been able to discern their features. Adam Loft was about 30, clean-shaven and broad-shouldered, dark and sullenly handsome, with the strength of one of the shire horses with which he worked. Nancy had once been pretty, but discontent and fatigue had left their mark, sapping away the good looks which she had formerly possessed. Her reddish hair was streaked with gray and hung in wisps, which she was forever pushing away from her forehead with the back of her hand. Lucy was a miniature replica of her mother at the same age. Judith Cromer could not have been more than 18 or 19. Millie had imagined from her voice that she would have been older, a bold and probably buxom hussy, but she was nothing of the sort. On the contrary, she was tall and slim, with beautiful hands and feet, and had an exotic charm which was almost oriental and which was unexpected to come across in the windswept plains of the Norfolk countryside. The next happening of which Millie had not been previously aware had taken place after tea on the day following the one on which she had learned of Judith's pregnancy. She had no means of knowing if it had occurred before or after that event. Adam had been shrugging on his jacket preparatory to departing for the Pelican when Nancy had said, "Lucy, run along, dear. I want to have a word with your father alone." Adam had paused with his fingers on the door latch.
"Can't it wait?" he had asked tersely.
"No," Nancy had been unaccustomedly firm. "Do as I tell you, Lucy." The small girl had left the room.
"Well, what is it?" Adam had demanded, and he was holding his watch in his hand to underline his impatience.
"I met Lily Rickett this afternoon," Nancy had said gently, "and she told me."
"Told you what?" Adam had asked brusquely.
"About you and that Judith Cromer."
"What about me and Judith Cromer? What did she say? Are you daft? You ought to know better than to gossip with an old faggot like Lily Rickett."
Even to Millie's ears, let alone Nancy's, it was obvious that he was put out and was stalling.
"She told me that every time I took Lucy over to Wotton to see Mother, Judith Cromer creeps in here to whore with you. That's what she told me. She says it's common talk."
Adam swung arrogantly around towards her. He slipped the watch back in his pocket and stood with his thumbs tucked behind the long links of its silver chain, rocking slowly on his heels.
"And did you believe her?" he asked expressionlessly. "And if you did, what do you think you can do about it?"
"If she comes here again," Nancy had said, "I'm going straight to her parents. That's what I'm going to do about it. She's a dirty, lustful little tart. That's all she is, coming into my house as soon as my back is turned and carrying on like a bitch in heat."
There had been a silence before Adam had said in a voice thick with anger, "I shouldn't act foolish, Nancy, if I were you. I really shouldn't." He had turned abruptly on his heel, and the door had banged behind him, and Lucy had stood staring after him until the picture had faded. Ida had gone to the station. There had been no flurry, no last-minute checking of what she might have forgotten. She was too well-organized and experienced to indulge in such behavior. Millie had received a peck on the cheek and had been told that Ida would be back in good time for supper on Monday, and would Millie please plant out the zinnias and dahlias, and she was not to forget to cut down on the milkman's delivery, for as Millie well knew, she abhorred waste. Millie had arranged to have luncheon with Miss Findhorn, but otherwise she had made no social engagements for the weekend. The afternoon was hot, with a hint of thunder, and the flower beds were dry, which had necessitated a lot of watering in case the storm did not break, which was questionable as the clouds were slowly drifting in the direction of the coast and will most likely spill themselves into the sea. It was when she had finished the task of bedding out and had washed her hands and taken the tea tray into the neat drawing room with its chintzes and lime-green walls studded with gilt-framed watercolors that she heard Nancy Loft's voice. She had stationed herself not more than 3 feet away from where Millie was sitting with the tray on her lap, and she was as clear and as real as if she had been there in the flesh. Millie had the odd feeling that it was she herself, and not Nancy Loft, who was in fact the ghost. She glanced quickly from the stiff figure of the woman to the doorway which framed Judith Cromer. "Won't you come in, Miss Cromer?" Nancy said. "Adam's not home yet." "Perhaps you would like to wait," she suggested with heavy sarcasm. "I expect you're taken aback to find me here." "When you have called before, I've never been in, have I?" she spoke with venom. Judith did not seem at all put out by this reception. "It was you I came to see today, Mrs. Law," she said with composure. "Adam told me that he would be working late." Nancy was by the side of the table, which had been laid out with half a loaf of bread and a slab of margarine, together with an open tin of sardines and 3 slices of cold pork that had been arranged on a chipped willow pattern plate. She waited for the girl to continue. "He did," she said at last. "Yes, I wanted to tell you that I'm going to have a baby, and that it is Adam's." "Does he know?" "Yes," Judith stepped forward into the room. "He is going to ask you to give him a divorce." Nancy laughed. "There's no harm in asking, is there?" The hatred between the two women was palpable. "Does he admit responsibility? A bun in the oven might be the work of more than one baker." "If you don't divorce him," said Judith evenly, "he will come away with me just the same. He hates you. You are repulsive to him. He's told me so frequently." "So you've decided not to face the music," said Nancy. "You're going elsewhere to have your bastard. I can't say that I blame you. It's your parents that I'm sorry for." Her face was pinched and white. "But I may as well tell you, Judith Cromer, that I will never divorce Adam. Not for you or any other slant-eyed slut from the village whom he may have seen fit to pleasure. He's no better than a Randy Bull. And now get out of my house," she said, her voice rising. "Get out before I do you and your disgusting brat an injury." She snatched up the bread knife from the table and stepped forward. The two women grappled desperately with each other for possession of the weapon. Their struggle seemed to Millie to last for an interminable time. Their feet scarcely moved, but their breathing grew loud and stentorous. Then Judith Cromer took a sudden pace backward, holding the knife, which had become steeped in blood, up to its bone handle. Nancy Loft sank to her knees, her mouth open as if in astonishment. As she fell, she clutched at the tablecloth, bringing the cups and plates crashing around her to the floor. Judith stood over her, gazing down in horror.
There was a step on the oilcloth in the narrow hall, and Adam came in. He stood stock still, taking in the tableau.
"Good God, Judith," he said. "Good God!"
The girl let the knife fall as she turned to him. Millie's hands were clenched. Over Judith's head, the young man was looking straight at her, and when he spoke, his words were slow and distinct, and his dark eyes held hers.
"So now you know, Miss Ackland," he said. "You have been watching us, and now you know the truth of what happened, although I took the blame. You're on to us, Miss Ackland, aren't you? And you will be the next if you talk, and talk you will. We'll get you one of these days, just you see if we don't."
Millie closed her eyes to shut out his livid, mocking face, and she was tense with terror. And when at last she dared to open them again, the room was empty and exactly as it had been, and she was once more alone. Upon her return from London, Ida was most distressed to find Millie in what she could only describe as a state of near collapse. After considerable pressure as to the cause, Millie was at length persuaded to talk, and Ida listened patiently and anxiously as her friend poured out the whole story. It was pure imagination, of course, but poor Millie appeared to believe every word of what she said. She must take her away for a holiday, and then she would realize what nonsense it had all been. Otherwise, unless she was able to put her groundless fears into proper perspective, in all probability, she would want to sell Rosemary Cottage, which would be sheer foolishness. It was decided, finally, that they should book on a 2-week cruise to the northern capitals at the end of the month. Millie had proposed that they should go to Greece with all its beauty and ancient cultures, but Ida had objected that it would be intolerably hot at this time of year, and besides, which they could not be able to afford to stay away for so long. Millie quite understood and was pleased with and grateful for the Scandinavian compromise. When they had been quite young women, they had gone together on a vacation to Rome and Venice, and Ida had proved herself a most entertaining and well-informed traveling companion. The next morning, however, brought an unexpected complication, for Ida received a letter from her brother Francis. He was in the habit of saying that she was more like his aunt than his sister, since he was 20 years her junior. He ran an art gallery in Manchester, and somewhat to Ida's surprise, a few years after his wife's death, he had married a young girl not long out of her teens, a competent, sensible, and nice-looking girl whose father had been his friend. Now it transpired she had met with an accident and was laid up with a slipped disc, leaving him to cope not only with the running of his business, but with the management of the house, and also of their 2-year-old son. Could Ida conceivably come and stay for 10 days to help him out? They were expecting an au pair girl from Madrid, but she could not be arriving for at least another week. Ida read through Discret Decor twice. She was very fond of Francis and knew how utterly helpless he would be in such a dilemma. She could not go for the whole of 10 days, but she would have to put in an appearance and try to find someone to tide him over. Men were so unenterprising. They accepted defeat so readily in any domestic crisis. She wondered how she herself would make out with a male 2-year-old. It would be so different from her girls. But what was to be done about Millie? If she were to leave her by herself, she wouldn't know a moment's peace. She could consult Monica Findhorn, who was a tower of strength. Perhaps she might know of some woman locally who might be bribed or persuaded to come in and oblige. It was both extraordinary and inconvenient that Frances's request should have arrived so soon after her London trip. It had been months since she had stirred from Rosemary Cottage, and now twice within a week? When Ida broached the matter to Miss Findhorn, that lady looked dubious. There was really no one in Saffron, no one at all.
Any available daily help was so quickly snapped up. She realized the urgency and would certainly make inquiries, and she would telephone Ida at lunchtime. She was sorry to hear that Millie had been unwell. It had been rather naughty of her not to have let her know. She would pop around and see her as often as she could, but that was by no means the same thing as having somebody living in, was it? She would have been delighted to ask her to stay, but at the moment, the spare room was being redecorated. Wasn't life difficult? Ida walked back to Rosemary Cottage, torn by conflicting loyalties. She would say nothing to Millie until the afternoon, but if she was to be of help to Francis, she could not long delay the answer to his SOS. At 1:05, Monica Findhorn telephoned, saying that she heard of someone who might be willing to move in for a short while. She was not acquainted with her personally. She was a Mrs. Terriman, and she was by no means young. As it happened, she was here on a visit from Tasmania and was a great aunt of Mabel Smith, who lived in one of the new council houses in Ramsden Road, and Mabel had told her that the old lady was becoming rather bored with nothing to do. She was nearing the end of a month's visit, for which she had practically invited herself. Mabel had not previously known her, but she had loyally decided that blood was thicker than water, and Mrs. Terriman had written that she had saved up for a long time to pay a visit to the old country. Ida went for an interview as soon as Millie had been settled down for her siesta, as she liked to call it. Mrs. Terriman was not young, but she was not as ancient as Miss Findhorn implied. She must, thought Ida, be roughly her own contemporary, maybe a little younger, a woman in her middle 60s. Still, she seemed pleasant and was prepared to be of assistance. She could start tomorrow, if Miss Rankin wished that she should do so, and could remain until Saturday or even Sunday. She must be in Southampton by Tuesday to catch her boat. As to remuneration, she would leave that to Miss Rankin. It was agreed that she should come to Rosemary Cottage on the following morning. Ida telephoned Francis to announce that she would be in Manchester the next evening. Millie accepted this arrangement cheerfully. She was aware that Ida did not want to let Francis down and declared that as she would have a companion, her friend must not give the matter a second thought. There was no problem. She would look forward to Ida coming back as soon as she had made the necessary arrangements for her brother. Mrs. Terriman sounded excellent, and it would only be for a few days. She had good bone structure, Ida had added. When she was young, she must have been quite beautiful. You'll get on together like a house on fire. Don't worry, Millie. But when the taxi had come and had driven Ida to the station, Millie felt some of her old fear return. She hated Ida going away and wished that the time would come for the beginning of their cruise. Dr. Cripps had been insistent that she take things quietly, so Millie stayed in bed until noon and retired again directly after the news at 9:15. She hoped that she was not giving too much trouble, but Ida had been adamant that she should carry out the doctor's orders. Millie comforted herself that by Sunday or Monday, when her friend would be back, such self-indulgence would be no longer necessary. At 7:30 on the evening of Mrs. Terriman's second day at the cottage, Millie could hear her preparing supper. The doors which gave from the drawing room and kitchen onto the passage were both ajar. Millie was lying on the sofa, an unopened copy of The Spectator beside her. She was scrutinizing the Queen, which she pretended to despise. It was Ida, who was a subscriber, as she liked to be au fait with the activities of her old girls, although Millie maintained that the publication was a frivolous extravagance. She put the magazine to one side and began a polite, if rather loud, conversation with Mrs. Terriman. Nowadays, you had to treat domestic help as human beings, try to make them feel a part of the family. It was no use being aloof. The supper would be simple. A cup of hot consommé, some cold beef and pickles left over from luncheon, and perhaps an apple. The beef had been far too rare for Millie's taste, almost blue.
but she had not liked to comment adversely on it. Had Mrs. Terriman, she inquired, ever regretted having immigrated? Life in Tasmania must be very different from that in England. It had a marvelous climate, or so she had heard. Had she many relatives living there? Mrs. Terriman replied that on the whole she liked it very much. She had one son and two granddaughters in Hobart. When their mother had died, the girls had been nearly grown up, and they had married early, so after she had lost her own husband, she had moved in to housekeep for their father. It was a fine country for the young, what with the sunshine and the space and all, and if Miss Ackland would pardon her for saying so, there was no class barriers, which was nice. Her visit home had been enjoyable. But she was getting to be an old woman these days, and it would be unlikely that she would be making another one. Of course, Tasmania had its snags, like all places, but there was plenty of scope out there, and people could get on in the world. Milly continued to talk. She had realized ever since Ida's departure that tonight would be Midsummer's Eve, and she had no desire to participate again as an eyewitness of the long-ago murder. If she went on chatting to Mrs. Terriman, there would be less likelihood that she would be swept in, and when she went up to bed, she would take a sleeping pill. "And did you know this part of the country when you were a girl?" asked Milly. "Or did you come to Norfolk just to visit your great-niece?" "I was Norfolk-born," said Mrs. Terriman. "Though they've all gone from hereabouts, that is. All of my immediate relations. I lost touch with them many years back. Mabel is the only one that's left. The two wars took a heavy toll of the menfolk, and Mabel's brothers went off in their turn, same as I did, one to New Zealand and the other to South Africa. She tells me they've done very well for themselves." She hesitated and added, "You might say I used to know this village well." "All the same, it must be sad," said Milly, "to see all the old places passing into new ownership." She paused and asked, "What was your maiden name?" Mrs. Terriman came to the door, and Milly saw that the big carving knife in her hand was red with blood. "My name?" she asked. "Why do you ask me that, Miss Ackland?" "It would mean nothing to you. As a matter of fact, it was Cromer. Judy Cromer." A chill breeze seemed to play over Milly, and she shivered. Judith Cromer had come back. She was here in this room beside her, and at Midsummer Eve. Milly studied her nails. She must not allow herself to look up. Was that the sound of the front door opening? Who was it that was coming in? She knew with a sudden ghastly certainty who it would be that she would see. Against her will, she raised her head. "Is there anybody there?" she called. Framed in the door behind Mrs. Terriman stood the burly figure of Adam Loft, and his expression as he watched Milly was one of triumph, and she heard once more his whispered words. "You're on to us, Miss Ackland, aren't you? And you will be the next. We'll get you one of these days." And she had talked. She had told Ida. Milly was gripped by a searing pain, as if a mailed hand squeezing relentlessly at her heart. She found it impossible to get her breath. This was death that had come to claim her, and she recognized it as such. She gave a strangled cry, and her head fell forward onto her chest. Mrs. Terriman had moved away her thoughts in the past. Judy Cromer had been her maiden name. It had been curious how drawn her mother had been to the letter J, James, John. Her elder sister, Judith, who had drowned herself on the day of Adam Loft's execution. Poor tragic Judith. It had been this very cottage that the young man had lived, and Julia. Why, instead of Judith, had it been herself, Julia, who had been the one who had always been known as Judy? It had been a family quirk, which had had no explanation. Hearing a sound of distress from the sofa, Mrs. Terriman hurried back into the room, the carving knife with which she had been slicing the beef still held in her hand. She knelt down by Millie. "Miss Ackland," she said with concern. "Miss Ackland, dear, what is it?" She felt for her pulse. "Miss Ackland, dear," she said once more. Then, with her face starched with worry, she went across to the telephone to call Dr. Cripps.